Well, just a few words of introduction. You know, I think we've all watched with some astonishment these democracy movements that have spread like wildfire, starting in Tunisia and then to Cairo, and now Jordan, Yemen, Syria, Bahrain. And like many in the room, I think we were all a bit shocked when, especially after such a tepid response from President Obama to Cairo and waiting so long, that they chose this military action of the no-fly zone along with NATO forces. And that's what's been going on for the last few weeks. And yet, you know, progressives... excuse me.
I'm sorry.
And then, you know, progressives are in a quandary about this because we have people like Susan Rice, who's the delegate to the United Nations. We have Samantha Powers, who is very strong on both Darfur and the Rwandan genocide, now a member of the National Security Council, apparently pressing Obama for these military actions. And the liberal press is singing the praises. You all probably saw last Sunday Nicholas Kristof's op-ed piece in the Sunday Times. And he says, quote, if the Libya operation is successful, it may help put teeth into an emerging doctrine of the, quote, responsibility to protect, quote, a landmark notion in international law that countries must intervene to prevent mass atrocities. And that might help avert the next Rwanda or the next Darfur. So these are the terms that it's being couched in. So I'm really delighted to have Vijay Prashad speak with us tonight, because Vijay, as many of you know, is a very strong and outspoken critic of some of these policies, but he really speaks from knowledge. Vijay is a professor and director of the International Studies Program and the George and Martha Kellner Chair of South Asian History at Trinity College. I tried looking up your CV today. I ran out of megabytes on my computer. Literally 18 books that he's been involved in, monographs and edited volumes. Some are quite well known. The Poor Nations, A People History of the Global South is forthcoming. Come Kalinga, The Impenitence of the Indian Right. I like that. The Darker Nations, he's very well known for A People's History of the Third World. Dispatches from Latin America. Experiments Against Neoliberalism, Keeping Up with the Dow Joneses, Debt, Prison, and Workforce. And it's probably his most well-known book, Everybody Was Kung Fu Fighting, Afro-Asian Connections and the Myth of Cultural Purity, Beacon Press wrote in 2001. He's the author of 60, I would say, peer-reviewed articles and uncountable number of popular articles for the press, for the blog, for the web. Many of you may have heard him on Democracy Now! Was it 2 weeks ago? Discussing just this issue of the U.S. Intervention in Libya. So I'm very pleased to present Vijay, and let's give him a big round of applause.
Okay. Thank you. You're very generous. My peers are very generous. They're called peer-reviewed journals, but we all know that they are friendly peers. Well, let me say, several years ago, when the events were overtaking Latin America, Tariq Ali, at a discussion, asked the question, where is the Chavez of the Middle East? And maybe that was a bad question, because maybe there is no personified Chavez. Maybe one looked for something else. Maybe one looked for popular uprisings and not the Chavez of the Middle East, but maybe, you know, the people of the Middle East now fed up with the stranglehold of a combination of pharaonic nationalism, imperialism, maybe Zionism, that these social phenomena, you know, had taken them to the brink and they rose up. So they form, in a sense, if you can picture the people in Tahrir Square as a sort of Chavez of Cairo, the people speaking. So, of course, it came as a great surprise. Who expected these events to take place? And who has talked at all about the fact that in Russia there was a drought last year? And that the drought last year, like that butterfly which decides to flutter its wings far away, had a huge catastrophic impact on food prices. And, you know, before Mubarak could sense that, you know, like Marie Antoinette and let them eat cake, before he could sense that the problem of food prices had convulsed households across Egypt and hastily tried to raise the subsidy rate. But before he could allow that to have any impact, of course, people had taken the streets. don't underestimate the amazing impact of things like droughts in one country having an impact. There have been riots and protests against the food problem globally. It just so happens not to strike the United States very hard because we tend not to buy primary goods, and so the price differential, when we are unable to import inflation quickly as countries where people are reliant on primary goods. After all, if we eat processed rice, the value added is already so high that the increase in the price of rice at the field hardly impacts the incredibly inflated price we already pay for, that 6-minute rice or whatever it is that we buy in boxes. The value added has already killed the inflation. So it's not the case that we would get impacted as strongly. But around the world, there have been protests against the food price rise. So keep that in mind, because that certainly has to be a part of this equation. Okay, so I'm not going to spend time talking about the whole spring. I want to concentrate on the U.S. government's complexity and its problems. And I would like to spend time on Libya, because that's what I know best of all. So, well, yes, Tunisia takes place, Ben Ali disappears, he takes over. Probably I fantasize that he is living now in Idi Amin's old house, because somewhere in Saudi Arabia there is an entire street of houses which are kept open for all the fleeing dictators from Africa and the Middle East. Mubarak went to the seaside, but he could just as well have become the roommate of Ben Ali in some palatial mansion, and in Tripoli they are looking at real estate somewhere in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia, as you know, is a refuge of scoundrels, including, of course, of the royal family, who met with Robert Gates recently and have started to dictate the terms of geopolitics in the region, which is extraordinary. And I'll come back to that in a little bit. So Ben Ali flees, and then you get Egypt. There is a contagion, certainly. It's over-exaggerated that this thing is about Facebook and Twitter. You already know that. You know, the telephone doesn't make the revolution. The telegraph doesn't make the revolution. But they certainly help. Means of communication certainly help. So at the same time as one shouldn't exaggerate the role of Twitter, Facebook, you must not also, set it aside. I mean, after all, in the Russian Revolution, it was helpful to have the telegraph after you could send messages saying what's happened here, what's happened there. Communication is certainly essential. But, come on, from Cupertino, California, they are not engineering the world revolution. We know that, but let's not still set aside Facebook and Twitter. These things are important. So, in Egypt, the contagion spreads. Now, of course, there are a concatenation of events that lead to the occupation of Tahrir Square. There's, of course, as I said, the bread prices. And, of course, and don't forget the other important thing, they have public space. They have meaningful public space, something that in many, advanced industrial countries we don't have. Imagine if we decide to go and sit in, where would we sit in Washington, D.C.? Where would we be allowed to even gather for 5 minutes? The places of importance have been closed off to us. We cannot enter them. You have to get a permit. If you violate the permit, you're going to get... we don't have public space like that. So you have to recognize the centrality of public space and the symbolic meaning of something named Tahrir Square. People occupy it, fine. What is the U.S. government's response? It was not anemic. It was actually kind of diabolical. They sent a man who I followed since the 1990s, partly because I have files like the counter CIA. My office is filled with filing cabinets of information on different people that come past my eye. They sent Frank Wisner Jr. Now, Frank Jr. has, of course, an interesting family history. His father was an important CIA man. His father was the guy who created Wisner's Wurlitzers, sending paid press agents all over the world to promote anti-communist messages. That was Wisner Sr. helped overthrow the government of Guatemala, Arbenz. Frank Wisner Jr. was involved in the overthrow of Mossadegh. He was like everywhere. He was the CIA's main architect, and then he committed suicide. He used his son's gun, Frank Wisner Jr.'s gun. Frank Wisner Jr. had just graduated from Princeton, and then he escalated quickly up the chain in the State Department. And he found himself in the late 1980s and 1990s as ambassador in three important countries. First, he was ambassador in Egypt between 1986 and 1991. Crucially, he was ambassador in Egypt during the time when Gulf War I was to happen. That is to say that Saddam Hussein on August 2nd, 1990 invaded Kuwait. and the United States went in to Saudi Arabia to throw Saddam out of Kuwait, the United States needed Egyptian support. And Wisner Jr. was able to get Mubarak to support the ouster of Saddam from Kuwait. They became very close friends. Then Wisner will go to the Philippines, where it turns out that as part of the so-called decommissioning of American military assets, the Subic Bay base is to be decommissioned. It was decommissioned for a few years, then recommissioned, because we needed the bases back. When it was decommissioned, a power plant was languishing on the property, and miraculously, a company that some of you may remember, some may not remember, you were not born when this company existed. It was an incredible company. Its name was Enron. And Enron, this incredible company, decided to come in and take over the power plant. Then Frank Wisner Jr. goes to India. He's the ambassador in India. And while he's in India, Enron is interested in building an enormous liquefied natural gas plant. And nobody's interested. 13 days, a right-wing government stays in office. The only bill they sign is to authorize Enron to build the liquefied natural gas power plant. Frank Wisner Jr. resigns from the State Department and joins the board of Enron. Yes. And then he comes to the United States, where in the foreign policy apparatus, this weird zone between Houston, Texas, and Washington, D.C., with assorted stops in Virginia along the way, they write reports about the rest of the world. Now, why Houston? Because that's where you have the Bush Institute, the Baker Institute, and all these places where these very important so-called bipartisan reports are written about the world. Frank Jr. wrote a series of reports saying how Mubarak is the great reformer. And after the last election, which Mubarak walked away with 90%+ of the vote, Frank Wisner Jr.'s assessment was, this is a great day for Egypt. Obama sends him to talk to Mubarak. And Obama sends him to talk to Mubarak while there is a demonstration across Egypt, and the military is also teetering on the side of the rebellion. One member of the military is sent off to Washington, D.C. He is General Tantawi. He becomes a familiar name later. So the general is sent to Washington to talk to the Pentagon. Frank Wisner Jr. arrives in Egypt. Then he makes a very poor judgment at a video conference in Munich. He will say that Mubarak should be allowed to have some time because he needs to cement his, the worst possible word, legacy. Okay. Everything hits the fan, and America is looking bad. Hastily, Mubarak is told, listen, chum, it's checkers for you, and Tantawi is going to be able to take over. Now, yes?
Could I ask a favor?
Go slower.
Yeah.
But I have so many things to tell you. Just don't let it fit. Just believe me. Okay, I'll go slower. So, then, in Egypt, now, there is no, I don't want anybody to think that I'm trying to say that the Egyptian revolution was not important and was not central. Because one of the things that I think we need to pay very close attention to is how when revolutions seem not to succeed, they have succeeded. In other words, if you look at the revolution of 1968 worldwide, okay, young people from Japan to Paris to, you know, Karachi to Mexico City, rebelling in Columbia University, Madison, Wisconsin, rebelling all over the world. It looks like right after their rebellion ended, they cut their hair off, went to Wall Street, Reaganism and Thatcherism arrived, etc. But guess what? Because of that rebellion, certain communitarian ideas also come to stay. Feminism is going to be cemented through that period. So there's a lot that's won. New social identities will be created, even though it appears sometimes that a revolution has not succeeded. So please, when I say that in Egypt, the general will come and certain concessions are made, and the important 1979 so-called peace agreement between Israel and Egypt will have to stay, that doesn't mean that this has not been an incredible revolution. That new social horizons have not been created, because they have been created. New social horizons have been created so that in this current referendum, there was incredible agitation that more was not being provided. So Egypt, despite the fact that the United States played a very bizarre game, not necessarily bad game, but bizarre, he would not have been my first choice as the American envoy, particularly because the United States has an interesting ambassador in station, and her name is Margaret Scobie. And you will find some interesting feature in the State Department. There are some incredible women ambassadors. Margaret Scobie in Cairo, and Ann Patterson is in Islamabad, Pakistan. But the United States government prefers to send these guys like Wisner to Cairo to deal with Mubarak rather than Margaret Scobie, who has actually a genuine commitment to human rights. They'll prefer to send a repellent man who died and was celebrated like he was a god, Richard Holbrooke, to Islamabad, rather than let Ann Patterson deal with the Pakistanis. She has a genuine commitment to human rights. It's very interesting how there's this pattern. There'll be these women sent as ambassadors, but they are just treated on the side. And when you read the WikiLeaks cables from Islamabad, you will sense Ann Patterson's deep frustration. So, that was the story in Egypt. Very bizarre case of sending Wisner. And then these revolts will start to come on the eastern rim of the Arabian Peninsula, particularly in Bahrain. Now, the thing about the eastern rim of the peninsula, I'm trying to build up for you the narrative of the pillars of stability, as it were, and why Libya on this end is going to become the place to intervene militarily. So I'm going to tell you a little story about eastern rim as I understand it, and then come over to Libya. In 1979, the big pillar of stability, that is Iran, is going to suffer, as far as U.S. foreign policy is concerned, a defeat. That is, when the Iranian revolution takes place and the Islamic Republic is created shortly thereafter, it removes the principal pillar of stability from the column of U.S. power. And the United States then is going to put very many more of its hopes in the Israeli basket, and partially in Iraq. Of course, Iraq is going to get financed, the war will begin. But forget all that. Inside these countries, Saudi Arabia in the lead, Bahrain, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, these countries will gather in 1981, and they will create an organization called the Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC. And the GCC will be formed in 1981 with the express purpose of defending the monarchies, the emirates, against Iranian intervention. That is its principal raison d'etre. It will also say we want to create a monetary union, we want to create a free trade area. All that stuff is secondary or tertiary. I mean, till today, the movement towards creating a Gulf dinar has gone nowhere. That's not a primary reason for the existence of the GCC. The main reason is they do military exercises together, and they try to coordinate ideological and military strategy vis-a-vis so-called Iranian intervention. Why are they afraid of Iran? They're not afraid of Iran because of Iran. They're afraid of Iran because of a simple demographic problem. And the demographic problem they've tried to solve, it hasn't worked. The demographic problem is this, that along this rim, a large part of the population in some of these emirates, a majority of the so-called native population are Shia and not Sunni, like the monarchies. So the assumption is that the Shia are dangerous. Of course, they are not just dangerous as Shia. Since the 1950s in Saudi Arabia, in the eastern part, there have been working class rebellions in the oil regions. You know, this is the bulk of where Aramco used to have its oil fields, Taf and all these cities around here. In the eastern part of Saudi Arabia, oil workers, the skilled oil workers, that is the sort of labor aristocracy, are from the Shia community. So every time there was an oil strike from the 1950s, and these oil workers would strike, often taking great inspiration from Nasserism, the growth of this feeling of Arab nationalism after 1952, when Gamal Abdel Nasser and his coterie will conduct a coup in Egypt in 52. So Nasser will fly into Dharan in 1956, and he'll be greeted with oil workers cheering him on. This terrified the Saudi monarchy. And what you begin to see is an attempt to dislocate these working class struggles by calling them not oil worker struggles, but the revival of the Shia. And these are going to be communalized, or they're going to be sectarianized from the 1950s. The government in Saudi Arabia will say this is the Shia fifth column. This is Iranian influence here. When in fact, these people are basically not Iranian, they are not Persian by their self-estimation, they are Arabs, they are Arabic speakers, they happen to be Shia, and they happen to be oil workers, many of them, not all. And one of the ways that the GCC tried to undercut the Shia underclass, one of the ways was to suggest that they are a malevolent influence from outside. They're being influenced by Iran. And after 79, this was a huge attempt. You know, they are from outside, they are the Iranian influence, the Wafik party is influenced by people in Iran, you know, these are, should be banned because they are trying to spread the Iranian revolution. The other way that these were attempted to be undercut was a massive importation of foreign workers, particularly from South Asia. So in places like Bahrain, you know, I think 40% of the workforce is from South Asia. And they will come in, and then there will be those residual tensions at the bottom end of the work chain. So these were the two ways in which these countries attempted to defuse a ticking time bomb, which was a time bomb which had all kinds of manifestations. Of course about dignity, of course about the fact that they were an oppressed population. They felt that their religious identity was not recognized. But certainly it had a lot to do with the fact they were oil workers, low level in the economy, and they wanted a greater share of the massive oil profits coming into their societies. So when the Bahrain event takes place, you have to understand Bahrain is like an island with a bridge that leads to Saudi Arabia, what they call a causeway. And it's a beautiful place. Unlike Sarah Palin in Alaska, you know, where you can see Russia, she said, you can see on a clear day Iran from Bahrain, because it actually sits out there in the Persian Gulf, you know, like a little island with a causeway attached to it. Now, Bahrain is running out of oil. It is estimated that this year or next year will be the final years of Bahraini oil. So there's a great deal of tension in this country about its so-called developmental path, which in Adam Smith's terms would be deeply unnatural. I don't know if anybody reads Adam Smith, but Adam Smith believed that the natural economy was agriculture first, then industry, and then trade. And he said the natural one is China. The unnatural one is Holland. Foreign trade first, then industry, then agriculture. He called that the unnatural mode. Well, Bahrain would be the super unnatural mode because it's oil and oil and oil. And I don't know what you'd call Dubai, which is a fantasy mode of development. Hotels and islands and... How many of you have been to Dubai? Only one or two people. It's a fantasy. It doesn't exist on the planet Earth. It's... When I was small, I was flying to England, and we used to, the plane from South Asia would land in Manama. That was before Dubai. Manama and Aden were the two airports. Now, nobody flies to Manama unless you're crazy, really, because unless you want to go and see how beautiful it is, because Dubai has overrun the whole area with its airport. It is one giant mall. That's its mode of development. So when Bahrain opened up, this was seen, I think, very astutely by the royal family in Saudi Arabia as a direct challenge to the Emirate model. And, you know, Yemen could be handled. I think they understood that Yemen could be handled. There were all kinds of institutional supports to handle the uprising in Yemen, and they've handled it very smoothly. There's a so-called prolonged transition. And if you want, we can talk about that later. There's a very prolonged transition, and a lot of blood is going to be shed in Yemen. And the boogie of Al-Qaeda is incredible there. You know, but Bahrain, when the GCC made a decision, they said, we are going to have to put this down. There is no way any reform will be allowed because the door must not open. If the door opens in Bahrain, it will spread everywhere. Okay, now, just keep that in mind because there will be a certain agreement that takes place that helps the Arab League make up its mind vis-a-vis Libya, which has Bahrain as part of the story. Okay. 15th of February, a human rights lawyer, 39-year-old human rights lawyer by the name of Fateh Terbil, is arrested in Benghazi. Now, he's an interesting man. He is a young lawyer, 39 years old, who's representing the families of 1,000 people who were killed in 1996 in the Abu Sina prison in Benghazi. Benghazi? Tripoli. They were killed in Tripoli. 1,000 people in 1996. Libya has had a series of rebellions from the 1980s. But, you know, nobody cares because what people, the way the Libya is portrayed, everybody says a closed society. It's not that closed, but what people concentrate on in Libya is the foibles of Gaddafi. He's a colorful character. People know when he came to New York, he brought his tent. When he was in Italy recently, he said to the Italian TV broadcaster, they said, what do you think is the future of Europe? And he, because he's an insane person, said, the future of Europe is Islam. You know? I mean, he does things like this at the G8 meeting. He would go and change the seat names around so he could sit next to Obama. You know, the media is concentrated on that. People don't observe that Libya has had a series of rebellions. In 1980, a major rebellion in the military. And why is there these rebellions? One of the real reasons, one of the principal reasons, is Libya has an east-west cardinal divide. That is a big piece of it. There is, when from the Ottoman period, the vilayats were divided up, and there's a great sense of remove between the two. In fact, when Gaddafi conducts his coup in 69, he overthrows King Idris, who's the king that comes from the east. Benghazi was the old capital of Libya. And so there is a east-west divide for you to keep in mind somewhat, but it need not be fully, completely exaggerated. Then there are, when Gaddafi comes in 69, he favors a few groups. The first tribe that he favors is, of course, his own tribe. Then he favors the other tribe, which is the army officers around him. You know, they are the really favored tribe. And then there are some, and then some tribes are repressed, and conservative religions are repressed initially. Gaddafi doesn't come as a secular leader. He comes as a kind of social justice Islamist. You know, he has a green book. He sets up this Islamic movement to go and overthrow, in Chad and other places, the kind of Islamic socialism that he wants to export from Libya. So he's not a secular leader like Nasser was. He was a more complicated, bizarre ideology that he had. I may be the only one in this room that's read the Green Book. It's not necessary for you to read it. It's not very interesting. It's quite rambling, a little bit like his son. His son, Saif, has inherited a lot from his father. It's kind of rambling, bizarre. And I'll get to Saif in a little bit. So 15th of February of this year, Terbil was arrested in Benghazi. Now, he had planned to hold a Days of Rage, just as was held in Egypt, and just as was held in Bahrain, and just as was planned in Saudi. But a few days before the event could take place in Saudi, in the streets of Riyadh outside his home, the planner of the owner of the Facebook site was shot to death. That was not reported, I don't think. Was it reported? But how much was it reported? Like this. Yeah, fine. I mean, I don't know how many people even knew there was a Days of Rage to have happened in Saudi Arabia. You know, it's inconceivable, right? Saudi, all the women wear hijab, all the men wear jalabiya. Our images come from Michael Moore. That offensive film, that film was okay, but those scenes were offensive. Of this sort of excess of Saudi men walking around. You know, you remember that? What is that movie?
Fahrenheit.
There were these scenes of Saudi men roaming around, and it was meant to revulse you. I thought that was a little disgusting. that's the way they dress. What's wrong with that? There was a scene of one Saudi man holding George Bush's hand, a little homophobic, and it was a problematic section in that movie. You know, it was emphasizing, look, he's silly. But at any rate, Days of Rage to be planned February 17th. February 17th is an important date. Why? In 2006, most recently, on February 17th, there was a demonstration in Benghazi around the Danish cartoon controversy that some of you may know. And Gaddafi, which is his mood, cracked down on it, 11 dead on the streets of Benghazi. And so what Terbil had decided, he's the lawyer defending the families of the 1996 massacre in the prison, said, on the 5th anniversary of February 17th, let's have a demonstration. And he's arrested. So the contagion comes from other parts of the Arab world, and there are small sporadic demonstrations in Libya in February 17th. And something is brewing for sure. In Benghazi, parts of the military go over to the side of this inchoate rebellion. Gaddafi is cracking down. Similar kind of taste of steel as the Saudis demonstrated, you know, but again, that is underneath. One doesn't see that much. And the steel that the Bahrainis put forward, that is also underneath. We talk about Facebook. I'll introduce you to the head of the Human Rights Commission in Bahrain. He has a Facebook site. He puts regularly pictures of people who have disappeared. You know, I don't know. That is a disappeared story itself. Today there was something in the paper, and the Bahrain government immediately said it was a bad story in the New York Times. So, what did I say? 15th, and Gaddafi starts to crack down. Now, he cracks down in a way only he knows. You know, Gaddafi is a little bit that way, like the Syrian father, Hafiz al-Assad, not this one. This one is a sophisticated dictator. His father was a brutal dictator. 10,000 people killed in a city, you know, in an uprising, right? 1982. 10,000 dead. That guy, you know, bodies meant nothing to him. Gaddafi is like that. Brutal guy. Then on 26th of February, as the rebellion starts to increase, what is that rebellion's character? I'll get to in a minute. The UN Security Council passes a resolution 1970, which says arms embargo on Libya. This was an important resolution. It said arms embargo on Libya. Gaddafi, you are under watch. Very important resolution. The African Union meets. The African Union is a rather toothless body when it comes to Libya because Gaddafi is the great paymaster. You know, and nobody had the nerve or will to do anything except that they put together a very high-level panel to go to Tripoli and talk to Gaddafi. So that was being set up. The Arab League also said we are going to try to put some pressure on him. So that was 26th of February that you had this happen. 27th of February in Benghazi, a transnational council is created. And they declare that we are the government of Libya, not Gaddafi. And some characters will come there, which I'll also get to in a minute. Gaddafi will start moving his troops out towards the eastern part. There are troops who have defected, remember, and they engage Ras Lanouf, they'll engage Brega, they'll engage Ajtabiya. They go back and forth, even in the early days. So far, there was no talk of massacre. Okay, they were fighting back and forth. And this is why I didn't understand how many people on the left here started to suddenly talk about massacre. You know, people like Gilbert, who I respect greatly, also said a massacre was coming. I was not sure what they were talking about because the Gaddafi's tanks were far outside Benghazi and not approaching the city when the talk of massacre now started coming in late February, early March. By then, some equations had changed. And the equation that changed for me was a new cast of characters will come in Benghazi. The first cast of characters, who are the rebels? The rebels were these human rights people, people like Terbil. The rebels were various entrepreneurs and business people who had come up largely because Gaddafi in the last 15 years has promoted privatization and has in a sense created these new social identities. A set of them had in fact fashioned themselves as the February 17th movement, which is why on some of the rebel tanks you will see February 17th written in paint on the tanks. So secondly, there are these people coming. Then there were young people generally in the East, but also working class people in the West who are restive. You know, in two or three cities, Misrata, Zintan, inside Tripoli, in some working class areas, there was rumbling, certainly. And a movement was developing. And then the last cast of characters were the people whose commitments were toward political Islam. But that has an interesting history. Eastern Libya has a long history of Islamic-based rebellion. It is from that region that you had the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group was formed in the late 1980s, I think. It's from the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group that people went to Afghanistan and fought alongside the Mujahideen against the Soviets. It's from that part of Libya that from towns like Drega that people went to Iraq. In fact, there's a great WikiLeaks cable where a U.S. State Department official from Tripoli bunks his minder and drives along the Mediterranean road, gets to a city in the east, talks to some people, and the sheikh tells him that, yes, people from here are going to fight in Iraq, but we are not going to fight in Iraq because we want to fight against Iraq. For Iraq, we are these young boys are going because they cannot fight in Libya. That was a great cable. You know, so Iraq was standing in for Gaddafi, in a way. So you have these elements, but you have to remember that in the 1990s, Gaddafi smashed the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. And then after the 1990s, many of their leaders came out with a sort of anti-extremist form of Islamism. So they are not, it's the bogey of Al-Qaeda. You know, Al-Qaeda, this bogey in Mali, Al-Qaeda, the Maghreb, I mean, those are Tuaregs, those are trans-Saharan smugglers. You know, Al-Qaeda for a lot of places is like a franchise. If I sold hamburgers on like 53rd Street in New York City, you wouldn't buy them from me. You know, you'd think, what are these, some halal burgers or whatever. I'm not going to. But if I called it McDonald's, you'd come. So these trans-Saharan smugglers, they said, Al-Qaeda of the Maghreb. And they said, now our shop is open for business. I mean, there's a Dutch reporter that I spoke to who has spent a lot of time in northern Mali. He said these guys wouldn't know Al-Qaeda, you know, from Salafi, like a text. These guys don't know any of that stuff. This is just a thing. Now, there are, of course, some hardened fellows in there. you know, no doubt about that, but it's not the general trend. Similarly, in Libya, by all accounts, these are not your Al-Qaeda, you know, the small core, the hardened people who are willing to sacrifice like that. They are definitely inspired by Islam in one variety or the other, but this is not like some the tentacles of bin Laden. So that's simply a silly thing. So that, those were the rebels. This is a kind of ragtag bunch of people. They had come to this. Many were not prepared to sacrifice. That was the other thing. Is John Lee Anderson is there right now, and he writes to say that he visited some rebels who told him, you know, we went to the front and they were shooting at us, so we came back. We didn't want a part of this. And, you know, I sympathize with them. I don't want to be somewhere with people shooting at me, you know. I mean, I'm a coward. I don't want that. I would like to stand in a square and, you know, have the camel riding brutal fellows come in and the Muslim Brotherhood let them go and face them and die, which is what they did in Tahrir Square. It's the Muslim Brotherhood that went and faced because they are disciplined, trained, and you know what? They believe in the future. Whereas I'm not fully convinced. I'm very much a liver in the present. You have to have an eschatology. You have to believe in like the revolution or in, you know, some heaven or something to... If you don't believe in the revolution, you will not sacrifice. If your teachers tell you, by the way, don't be teleological, what they're telling you is don't dream and have faith in the future. You know, you have to be teleological if you're political. You have to believe that it's going somewhere. Fine, in a paper you should be nuanced and all that, but teleology is essential for politics. And those Muslim brothers, they are teleological, believe me. They believe they're going to win. They are really... And so are some of the... Some people, not all of them. Many came back and said, thanks. You know, it's not fair. Gaddafi is not playing fair. What did you expect him to do? He is a brutal leader of a country who has crushed every single rebellion beforehand. You cannot take up arms unless you're prepared to fight him. You cannot go and face him and then turn around and say, he's not playing fair. The same thing happened in Bahrain, and people were crushed, sent home, and they are regrouping and ready and hardened and ready to fight again. So we have to have a long view when we understand these movements. Now, the United States played, a very tricky game here. Some characters will enter the story. So I've told you a little about the rebels who come February 15th and 17th and up to the Transitional Council. Now, one mysterious guy shows up in Benghazi. Now, I got a tip from somebody about 2 weeks ago, look at Hifter. So I said, what do you mean, look at Hifter? Then he said, I'll give you two words, you do the rest. Hifter, Vienna. So I said, what is Hifter, Vienna? I have a friend who knows Washington, D.C. in and out. So Vienna, oh, that's a town in Virginia. Call the town hall, any Hifter? Yes, Khalifa Hifter. He's got a house, something, Country Road. He just sold it for $612,000. He had bought it in 8 years ago for $640,000 or $60,000. He made a $40,000 loss. I talked to some people, clarified he lived there. Fine, I found out simply from driving directions on MapQuest, 7 miles from Langley. So Khalifa Hifter lived in Vienna, Virginia for about 20 years. So who is this guy? In the 1980s, he was a colonel in the Libyan army fighting the war in Chad. And at some point in the army, in the war, not clear when, he went over to the rebel side and joined the Libyan National Salvation Front. And then the regime in Chad will change. I think, what is his name? Habre. Helene Habre regime. And then Hifter disappears from Chad. Now, how many people here have been to a U.S. embassy trying to get papers to enter America? Anybody been? Yes? How easy is it? You go there, they're welcoming, come on, hug you, shake your hand, champagne, you win the lottery. How did this guy, who was a colonel in the Libyan army, fighting an insurgency in Chad, show up weeks later in a house in Vienna, Virginia? 7 miles away from Langley. He lives there, and from the United States, he will start an organization called the Libyan National Army. Post office box in Virginia. And then, they will attempt a coup in 96, crushed. Late February, early March, he shows up in Benghazi, and he is now the leader of the troops. So So on the ground, you have Hifter I, colonel, and the former interior minister, who is the titular general. They have taken over the fighting on the ground. That is now late February, after the UN resolution 1970, early March. Definitely by 11th March, he was in charge of the troops, whatever the troops may be.
Rebels,
correct. He is on the side of the rebellion. So that's the military leadership. I'm going to come back to the military question. Then there's a civilian leadership. Now, again, a provisional council is created. All kinds of popular democratic things are happening. It's all going fine in Libya. I mean, Gaddafi is going to strike. But there's all these popular initiatives starting. All that will end. A new man will take charge of details at the political end. And his name is Mahmoud Jibril. Now, Jibril is an interesting character. He was Saif al-Islam's right-hand guy. And he ran the so-called, what you might consider, the privatization ministry in Gaddafi's regime. Now, Gaddafi, from 69 to maybe the late 70s, he ignored the political question. That is, Gaddafi is one of the few leaders in the world who centralized power and called it decentralization. I mean, it's like an extraordinary thing. You know, he called these popular democracies. He still says, I am not a leader. I'm just an ordinary man. I'm not even the leader of Libya. And next breath you say, you'll never remove me from power. So, first 10 years, incredible moves that he makes. You know, he radicalizes OPEC on the global stage. He will bring in, he'll nationalize, he'll throw out the Hunter, Bunker Hunt and the Hunt brothers and all these Occidental Petroleum, and he tosses them all out. Very radical first 10 years. He improves the livelihood of the people, no question. In fact, Libya, on economic grounds, has the highest human development index in Africa. First 15 years or so, he's doing fine. Then, when the oil money starts coming in, I mean, this guy is like he's damned by that. Why? He starts to privatize the country. That's one. He will beg the US and Europe and others to bring him back into the fold. There's a hiccup in 86 when there's a Gulf of Sidra incident and a bombing in his compound, and his adopted daughter died. Now people say may not have died. I don't know. Let's just assume she died. Hannah. Some people say she's still alive. I don't know. He has 7 children. And 2 adopted children. But anyway, it is said at that time that she was killed in the bombing. Some hiccups, but Gaddafi from the 80s is reaching out to the West. And there are 2 men who become central to the outreach. One of them is Mohammed Jibril, who will conduct this privatization. And if you go to WikiLeaks, which, by the way, is my nighttime reading every day, as you can see, in WikiLeaks, he is meeting the ambassador all the time and telling the ambassador things like, you people made a mistake after 1989. That's my favorite cable. He says, you made a mistake. You should not have put boots on the ground in the Arab world. You should have used soft power. Then you would be on top. Like, for instance, McDonald's. Sell everybody McDonald's. You'll mesmerize them into loving America. So Jibril enters as essentially the political officer of the rebellion. And he is in the Elysee Palace in Paris. He is in London. He is everywhere. He's the kind of classic neoliberal guy, educated University of Pittsburgh in strategic engineering. And his task before he went to the rebellion was to privatize and make efficient the 11,000 state companies that are under the government's control. I mean, Libya is a bizarre country. Even the barber shops and everything was nationalized. So everything is under state control. So his thing was to make those efficient. So he brings in Ernst & Young and the Oxford Group and people like that to come and make things efficient. So Jibril is the political guy. Second person sent overseas to try to smooth international feathers was Gaddafi's very close ally from 1969. And his name is Kusa Musa. Important character, is sent abroad. In fact, he will negotiate with the British over Lockerbie, will negotiate with the Americans, with the Maltese and others. Sophisticated guy. Now, Jibril joins the rebellion. Hifter comes flown in to lead the military troops. There's still popular democracy going on underneath. People are still thinking that they're fighting a revolution, but it's slowly being usurped by this section. And this is happening. I'm going to come to Kusa Musa in a second. As this is happening, the new leadership in Benghazi says, we need air support. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not the same leadership as the young people in Tahrir Square. This is not even a Google executive. The actual people who say, now, we need air support, one, a CIA, maybe, I don't know. Maybe. He lived in Vienna, 7 miles from Langley, whatever it is. He is in charge, says we need air support. Jibril in Paris says we need air support. And of course, Ghosh Caviar, Bernard Henry Levy in Benghazi from a revolutionary bunker is calling his friend Sarkozy saying, you cannot make the mistake people made in Rwanda. Rwanda. I'd like you to think, what could the West have, who could the West have bombed to have stopped the genocide in Rwanda? People don't ask that question. Certainly the genocide should not have occurred. But who did you want to bomb when the Kagame brought the people across the border? Where would you have bombed? Why don't we have that discussion someday? You know, how would aerial bombardment have stopped that genocide happening? Separate issue, but anyway. But that's what Bernard Henry Levy said to Sarkozy. And that is exactly what Samantha Power, Susan Rice, and others said. A State Department official said the following. Very, this is good. I'll give you a few quotes. Soon I'll end, okay?
No,
I'll end soon. Please, God. First, I'm going too fast now. I forgot what I'm doing. No, I'll tell you. This is a very good quote. Samantha Power, as you know, has always wanted to revive the idea of humanitarian intervention. And their feeling was that Bush ruined it. That by going into an unnecessary war in Iraq, the concept of humanitarian intervention was compromised. And there was a need to revive it. So, Massimo Calabrese, who writes for Time magazine, reported that a senior official told him that there was an effort to shoehorn the Libyan events into an imminent genocide model. Okay, they had to make a case that the genocide was imminent. All right, this was important to them. And then he said that by late February, the people like Samantha Power, Jeremy Weinstein, both of the National Security Council, Susan Rice, U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Hillary Clinton, and others were, the quote is, laying the predicate for an intervention. Laying the predicate, lovely line, for the intervention. Okay, apparently at that time Robert Gates, pretty sensible guy, said this is a terrible idea. Because we are going to get embroiled in a civil war we don't understand. There's no end game. There are no interests that are available on the surface. All right. Now, let's put these two things together, Libya and Bahrain. But to get there, we need to go through one more UN resolution. On March 26th, the United Nations will sit again, the Security Council. This time, a very serious debate takes place about whether the United Nations needs to go beyond Resolution 1970. Resolution 1970 said no arms sales to Libya. Now the issue was they want a no-fly zone, they being the rebels in Benghazi. I've already told you who the rebels are. They are not quite the same as they were on February 26th when Resolution 1970 was pushed forward. This is a different time now. By the time we get from February 26th to March 19th, the game has changed a little bit. So March 19th, the discussion opens. In the Security Council, there is a characteristic difference available. Three countries, which since 2003 have been operating together as a bloc, India, Brazil, and South Africa, so-called IBSA bloc. They've had meetings since the Brasilia meeting of 2003. The IBSA bloc coordinates and says, this is a terrible idea. We cannot allow, just as Samantha Power and others wanted to revive humanitarian intervention, if some people wanted to say, we cannot allow humanitarian intervention to be revived. And a contradiction emerges in the Security Council, and Germany goes with the IBSA countries initially. Russia and China say, we do not favor intervention. In the middle of this debate, an interesting development takes place. The Arab League comes in and says, you must intervene. Otherwise, genocide is imminent. Now, what is the Arab League? 20-odd countries. The quorum was barely met when the Arab League met. There was something like 11 countries at the table. And a majority was produced in that meeting. The GCC countries voted for intervention. Saudi Arabia shoehorning everybody else. But they still had just a simple majority in the Arab League. When the Arab League said that, the Chinese and Russian says, we will abstain from the vote. In other words, we will not veto it. And joining them in abstaining was India, Brazil, and Germany. Obama personally called Jacob Zuma of South Africa, personally called him and talked to him on the phone and said, you have to vote with us on this. And Zuma then voted for Resolution 1973. Resolution 1973, to my mind, is a very dangerous resolution for at least three reasons. Reason number one is it is claiming to uphold R2P, responsibility to protect. But I think it muddies responsibility to protect for the second reason. It claims to do it, but it doesn't clarify in practice what responsibility to protect means, because for the second reason, it says the UN Security Council has the responsibility to protect civilians. But how do you tell who is a civilian, especially in the context of a civilian uprising against a regime? Are you defending civilians or are you going to support the rebellion? That clarity was not addressed. Therefore, this second problem actually confuses responsibility to protect. If this was indeed about responsibility to protect, you would really need to know whether you understand clearly who is a civilian. And that was not clarified. It was brought up in the debate that we are walking down a dangerous slope. Those are the two basic problems with R2P. R2P is an interesting idea, but it's always vague. It's an idea that actually is designed to make us feel better. Then it's something that we can clearly understand how to implement. What does it mean to have the responsibility to protect civilians somewhere else? What is a civilian? Any rebellion then should be protected? If we go out, 10 of us with guns and walk down the road, and the police come at us, SWAT teams, helicopters like in Philadelphia, you know, where they bombed the Honor Move headquarters and things like that, or what is it, Ruby Ridge? Should the UN protect them? I mean, they're just sitting there with guns in their house and the federal agents swarm. What is responsibility to protect? It's a very unclear doctrine. It's not a clear, when I'm surprised, well, actually not surprised, when Nicholas Kristof champions it like that, has he thought it through? I don't think so. He doesn't think too many things through. He goes for slogans. He's a little better than his friend Thomas Friedman, but not much better. It's a very unclear, scary doctrine to me. Third thing is more frightening. Susan Rice insisted in the middle of the debate that a phrase be added. And let me just read the phrase, because this is important. So the resolution of March 19th says that the United Nations Security Council must take all necessary measures, comma, then the United States added this clause, this thing. Very important. Listen to this. The United Nations must take all necessary measures, comma, notwithstanding paragraph 9 of 1970, comma, to protect civilians and civilian populated areas. That little phrase is very important. And it might sound nothing to you, but let me explain it. Comma, notwithstanding paragraph 9 of 1970, comma. Paragraph 9 of 1970 says arms embargo against Libya. Take all necessary measures, comma, notwithstanding paragraph 9 of 1970. What does notwithstanding mean? That means take all necessary measures regardless of paragraph 9 of 1970. In other words, we are setting it up to arm the rebellions. And this the UN Security Council had some problem with, but Rice put that in and it was passed. That's March 19th. In other words, March 19th says no fly zone. Fine. A list of names of Libyan leaders whose assets had to be sealed. Come back to that in a minute. So, no fly zone. Fine. List of names of people. And thirdly, arms may be given in some future time. It was not a responsibility to protect resolution. This was a resolution in support of the rebellion. Clearly. You'd have to be really... I mean, you don't need to take high-level literary criticism to come to this. This is a fairly straightforward thing for me. This was on 19th of March 2011, and the French bombs bomb within hours. Of course, you know they bomb everywhere, in Tripoli, etc. Never mind. They're bombing rebels also, 13 dead last night. Never mind. The important thing is this. The United States will move in two kinds of aircraft. AC-130 and A-10 Thunderbolt 2. I'm not a gun person. I had to read up on these things. These, when I read up, are very interesting kinds of vehicles. These are not to create a no-fly zone. These are boots in the air. They hover in the air and they use Bofa cannon and they fire at ground troops. So in a sense, we are already involved in the ground thing. And right now the rebels are saying, why have you withdrawn the AC-130? They said this yesterday. Bring them back. When they said American planes have left and the French are there, we want the American planes back. What they want is these airships. Because they will be like UFOs, hovering in the sky, firing at Gaddafi's troops. So that was 1970, the resolution. The deal cut that has been reported by the London Telegraph, other papers, why the GCC was so enthusiastic in the Arab League, why Saudi Arabia led the, you know, the troops in the Arab League, it is suggested by several of these reports, including by Pepe Escobar, who writes for Asia Times from Brazil. Pepe is a very good journalist. He talked to several Brazilian diplomats who confirmed some of this. And what the story is that the GCC said, we will back this to the hilt in the Arab League, but we must be allowed to crush Manama. Yeah. That we are going to go in the next day, and we're going to take care. And you will see the next day, Saudi troops will cross the causeway under GCC flag, and they will crush the rebellion in Bahrain. And under cover of the bombings in Libya, it was in the papers, Bahrain crushed, but who followed that crushing? So that's one thing I want you to consider. Then, as the troops, the rebels, move up the Mediterranean road towards Tripoli, a crucial member of Gaddafi's inner circle defects. Khusa Musa will go to London. Now, Resolution 1973, I told you, has a list of names of people whose assets were seized. Mm-hmm. Everybody there is there, including Shokri Ghanem, who's head of the oil corporation. Not directly involved in the military decisions. He is there. But Khusa Musa was not there. Why was he not on that list? Just a few days later, he will defect to Britain. He will fly in a Libyan plane and land in a British military airport. I don't know. I find this bizarre. You know, I'm not suggesting anything. I just don't know. I was talking to a journalist on NPR. I said to him, why don't you ask the government this story? Why was his name not on the list? Just a simple question. Yes, yes, I'll ask. Forget it. Today I was on Al-Hurra, the propaganda channel of the United States government that broadcasts in the Middle East and in Europe, and I asked them this question. They said, thank you very much for your insight. Close down. Okay, fine. Okay, so last, final thought. I've given you a sense of why I think we have intervened. I think that it's fair enough. Nobody wants people to unjustly suffer. I understand that. I understand why, you know, people, I think, lost their bearings with Libya. Reporting is terrible. There is no understanding of that part of the world. I mean, I'm talking about Libya. This understanding of other places, it's like a forgotten place. It's a laughing stock. The idea of the big dictator is so dramatized, you know, that he is a brutal guy. There's no sense that, you know, who is below, who are the other players, what kind of base of support they have. The military is now in the middle of a stalemate. American congressman has arrived in Tripoli yesterday, and he said to Gaddafi, we will make you an offer. Hope you won't refuse it. We want to make you the honorary chairperson of the African Union. Imagine. And we would like to have Saif al-Islam Gaddafi remain and run for elections. Imagine. I mean, imagine. This is the deal-making that may start now. Why? Because it's a military stalemate. It's a military stalemate because it was always going to be a military stalemate, unless the United States and French went full throttle, which they were not going to do. So that's where we are. So now we can you can ask me some questions. Okay. Hey, you can now. That timing. You can come and ask me a question. That would be good. Yes, please. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
First of all, I really appreciate your analysis. I heard you on Marcus now in that debate. And I was taken away from, I was subdued to the report from Benghazi late at night, BBC, right from Benghazi. And my memory is that when Gaddafi put down the Western protesters, there was no ability to understand how many people were being killed. So that's where the rumors of the massacre came. And then he made those statements that the people in Benghazi, there was going to be no mercy. So that sort of fueled the fire. But that's not my question. question is, there's a lot more confusion over the American motive here, particularly because Gates, who in my mind represents the Bush kind of cabal and the, those oil interests and whatever, was against this, which means that they had made friends with Gaddafi and he didn't want it ruffled, perhaps, to me. That the only other reason then is a humanitarian, or at least, as you say, to revive humanitarian intervention. Why did they go in? Was it that the reason? Or, as most lefties are saying, it's to get the oil, it's to get the... Well, why wasn't Gates and right-wing Republicans in favor if it's for the oil? You understand?
Okay, so the first thing I would say is I wouldn't say Robert Gates is reducible to the oil interests, because Gates is also a pragmatic head of a bureaucracy. And the bureaucracy he heads is the U.S. military, which is incapable currently of fulfilling its current obligations, let alone new obligations. I mean, it may cost up to several million dollars just to conduct a no-fly zone. And they're going to screw the country on Friday by closing the government down. I think he's a pragmatic head of a bureaucracy. I think that's how he was speaking from that point of view. That unless we are actually able to wind down Afghanistan, wind down Iraq, you can't enter Syria, you can't enter Libya, so that's one piece of it. I actually don't think this is directly related to American oil interests. There may be some French interests there. There was a Gaddafi, these things always come up. Why is it that before Saddam Hussein was invaded, he went to the OPEC ministry meeting and said, we need to shift our holdings from dollars to euros? Mm-hmm. Remember, he did that in the summer before, not summer, it was the summer of 2002. Oh, why, Gaddafi just a few months ago said that we're going to change our revenue sharing agreement. And most of the oil companies in Libya are European, many of them. Europe is the bulk buyer of Libyan oil. So there are all these things that are there, but it cannot be reduced to that because events move too quickly. Imagine they are sitting in the White House. There are long-term plans, which is why the Project for a New American Century brought out a statement saying, invade Libya. I don't know if you saw that. PNAC, they came out. Wolfowitz, invade Libya. That statement could have been Xeroxed from the invade Iraq, invade everybody statement. So there are these long-term ideologues, but there are also events that are moving too fast. But my feeling is the Libyan story is a combination, if you just take elite policy, it's a combination on the one side of, yes, sections in the White House that were looking to rehabilitate interventionism. That's definitely on the table. That's one piece. But another piece, as I suggested, is coming from here. The Saudi tail is wagging the American dog a lot. Gates went to Saudi Arabia, and the Saudis essentially read the act to him, and the New York Times published it like that. Saudi Arabia said, this, and this. Oh, sorry. This, and this. So there is something there that the Saudis were very scared. Abdullah called Al Khalifa to come and meet him in Riyadh. He summoned another emir. And tail between the legs, Bahraini, he came and said, Your Superb Highness, what can I do for you? And he said, Go back and smash them. So I think that's very much a piece of it. It's not all about, the other things that we think about. Because events did move so quickly. This really proves the domino theory. In a way. There is a wave that swept. Local grievances got caught up in a wave. And I think the Saudis looking at that said, oh my God, if Bahrain falls, we are going to have a problem here. Yeah, let's go there and I'll come back to you. Yeah.
The question, with all the billions that are in those private bank accounts, billions, is there a way for the alliance to get a hold of it and just buy off the supporters, the top supporters of Gaddafi, and offer them homes in England, France, America, or wherever? Because there are billions and billions of money.
Correct. And those houses, there's that house in London with a swimming pool, it's beautiful. I looked at those pictures of Saif al-Gaddafi's house, al-Islam's house. I think there are commitments and there are commitments. The other day, his daughter was on television, Libyan state television, talking about how she only watches Libyan state television, how great her dad is, and There are commitments and there are commitments. It's not always easy to buy people off. People also have a certain world view. You know, there's a view. There was a picture. Oh, I didn't bring it. New York Times had a picture of some rebels with a French flag on top of a tank. Mm-hmm. Imagine if you're seeing that in Tripoli. This is Italian colonialism. So, I mean, I would not say, plus I'm not an international finance expert. I don't know how easy it is to access bank accounts. You can freeze them. I don't know if you can liquidate them that easily. So I'm not sure that that's as easy as it seems. Remember, after Mobutu died, it was found that his bank account in Switzerland was equivalent to the debt of the DRC. 5 billion? Something like that? But it could not be transferred to the DRC. There's some private property problems. In other words, our greatest prejudice in life is private property. So I don't know if you can liquidate it that easily. Yeah.
So in your description of the talk before the talk,
yeah,
you had said that, you know, why the U.S. was in Libya was to quash the spring, you know, the Arab Spring, as you call it. But in tonight's talk, it sounds like America's just reactive to what Saudi Arabia's demands are. So what's the independent? It doesn't sound like there's a unified view in the U.S. government. It sounds like there's a lot of debate about it. But is that their main objective? Is it just placate Saudi Arabia, or do we have other...
Oh, no, I didn't mean to put it like that, Elliot. What I'm suggesting is that, you see, there is one way that these... Let's say if you walk into the Brookings Institution, there you will meet somebody who will say there are two modes of thinking in the Arab world. There are the stability people, and then there are the revisionists. And the great revisionist evil is Iran. And so the revisionists have to be prevented, and the revisionists have... their allies, Hezbollah, you know. So the revisionists have to be put in their box. And a lot of this discussion is about Israel, actually. The revisionists and then the stability people. And so that thinking is so much there in the State Department, it's nauseating. So if I let's imagine that you are in the State Department and they're having a briefing. So they will say, pillar of stability threatened. Pillar of stability must be upheld. Pillar of stability threatened. Got to reinstate stability in North Africa. Tunisia not yet confirmed Algeria problem. Strengthen Libya. I mean, I can imagine. This is how, I don't know if you've ever been to a briefing. They talk vulgarly like, you know, this is our stability. That is our stability. These are people who live there. They have dreams. They want to eat. They want to grow. They want to do things. But their view is... So, in other words, it's not just Saudis wagging the... Though I said that badly. It's that also this is a desired outcome. In other words, this cannot be ruffled. Gates went to Saudi Arabia and said to the king, our alliance is permanent. And your stability is our stability. A.K.A. the Carter Doctrine. The United States will come to the defense of the Gulf. I mean, the GCC's formation is actually a child also of the Carter Doctrine. Carter enunciates the doctrine in 80, I think, when he comes in the first year. And within a few months, they start the GCC process. These things are related. So I would say it's this, huh?
78
was the Carter. Oh, sorry, what am I saying? Yeah, so somewhere, I think it's right after the Iranian Revolution, maybe 80. Reagan comes in 81. So in 80, I think they formulate the doctrine. It's not before the Iranian Revolution. Somewhere in 80, and then 81, the GCC comes. These are together. These are hand in glove, I would say. So I would say that the bad behavior in Egypt with Wisner, and then this very bizarre set of events in Libya, unstable but bizarre, because I'm not saying Khalifa Haftar controls everything, or Jibril controls everything, but this very bizarre set of events that take place indicate an attempt to reinstate stability versus revisionism. I mean, remember, in the middle of all this, even the government of under Tantawi, you know, the great Egyptian general who's a friend, allowed what they called as two Iranian warships to go through Suez and dock in Syria. But one was a freighter and one was an oil supply vessel. But they were warships. When you saw pictures of them, they didn't look as scary as they sounded. Iranian warships have gone. First time since 1979. So that happens at the same time. So this idea of revision versus stability, that seems to me the biggest axis through which this world is observed. It's not seen as human beings with interests. I mean, how I would see it or you would see it. We would see human rights activists in Egypt, you know, in the lead. I would see, you know, this great young 39-year-old lawyer in Benghazi arrested. You know, let him lead Libya. This is not what is seen. What is seen is, where is stability? And they will turn around and tell you it is for your own good, because we are protecting the oil and protecting you against terrorism. And terrorism, a.k.a. Iran. Yeah, Sherry?
I think with all the events that's happened in Libya, I mean, to me, I would have loved to see Gaddafi go, because I don't think he's a good man. But now I think he's probably very dangerous, because he's seen all this, and I think that he'll want revenge for these things that have happened. Do you think they will intervene if Gaddafi actually keeps power?
I don't think, like I said, even failed revolutions succeed. In this instance, this is not 96, this is not 2002, this is not 1980. I think his base of power is demonstrably much less than it was then. I don't think he's going to be able to come in and clean up Benghazi. You know, Khuza Musa, who defected in 1980, was the Libyan ambassador to London. And he gave a speech in London saying all stray dogs should be taken care of. And the English asked him to go home. They sent him away. Why? Because what is stray dog? Stray dog means dissidents. Two Libyans were shot in London in 1980. And he was the guy with the stray dogs. Okay. So then in 1980, they were able to conduct foreign policy like that. They killed dissidents all over. They, you know, beat up. That game is going to be much harder to run now. Because the forward position of that is outside a certain area, I don't think they're going to be able to come in and clean up in Benghazi. It's going to be much more difficult. But which is why I think Libya is now a question of prolonged transition. What is the transition going to look like? The fact that the two sons, Saadi and Saif al-Islam, have made rumored outreach to the English particularly, saying that father is going to go somewhere, but we want to be part of the next dispensation. That might be the deal people will accept. They'll have to accept it. They'll have to accept it, because they do have some support in the West. You know, otherwise, what we're going to look forward to is 2004 to 2007 Iraq. In other words, cleansing.
Yeah.
Because Saddam did have support in Iraq. It had to be cleansed. It had to be sent back into the cage. You know, former Ba'ath people, they had to be either killed or moved into Ba'ath areas. So this may be a way, you know, short-term way to move. I don't know. But all I feel is that I don't think it's going to be possible. This is not like a head that you cut and everything is fine. And these people have a support. 80% of the Libyan population lived off oil revenues. So lots of people look up and say, he did great for us. Now, it may not be people on the east.
Yeah.
And it may not be working class people who have grievances. And by the way, they may have grievances if it was somebody less erratic. Because after all, it is a class structure. But is it a class structure in normal sense, or is it a diabolical class structure? I mean, we have what I think could be called a diabolical class structure. You know, but people don't, you know, I mean, there are 2 million people in jail or whatever, some huge vulgar numbers, right, high per capita thing. Our class structure is vulgar. We just don't rise up and then get smashed, unless, of course, you picture some people do rise up and they do get smashed. I mean, we don't like them.
One quick question.
Yeah.
One quick more quick question. I'm sorry. Well, I just ask one thing. Musa Khuza, though, I read, didn't take his family.
No.
Which is strange.
Yeah. He doesn't like them.
Yeah. May not like them. Let me come and then. No. It's a new way of doing divorce. I don't know.
I feel like you dropped us in the middle of the story. So
it is. We are in the middle of the story.
We are in the middle of the story. So I want you to go on telling it. What? I mean, here we are. We're still bombing the heck out of Libya. Things are flying. There's people up and down the streets and getting shot all over the east. The stuff is... What's going to happen next? No, you don't have a crystal ball, but you know a lot. What? Where are things going?
I'm going to help you read the news tomorrow. That's all. I can't tell you what's going
so
to happen.
What's tomorrow's news?
No, I don't mean that. I don't know. I cannot tell you.
You
I mean, right
is
now.
Is the process under control? Are we going to keep attacking?
No, the United States has withdrawn military operations currently. NATO is now conducting
right,
military operations.
NATO
but, of course, the greatest hardware is American hardware in NATO, but still.
Right. So are we going to intervene through NATO or directly or whatever? What's going to happen in Bahrain? Where are things headed there? And has Syria killed all the people they're intending to kill?
No, no, he is, your, if you have a gallery of dictators, young Assad is like sophisticated dictator exhibit A. He gave a speech 5 days ago where he said, it's like rebel in the name of the Tsar. In other words, the king is good, his officials are bad. Dismiss the cabinet. That's an old trick in the Arab world, the oldest trick. Dismiss the cabinet, dictator remain. But then what does he do? He makes a speech, which I thought was a brilliant speech. One second, I'll come. Brilliant speech.
But don't forget about the
No, no, wait. He makes a speech. He says, firstly, that where the rebellion is happening is Israel's doorway. So he says, conspiracies are afoot. But then he makes the classic why he becomes sophisticated, he says, every grievance is not a conspiracy. I heard that and I went, wow. Because all of them say, there are conspiracies. You are cockroaches. I will put you down. The real people of my country are, right? Are being, by the cockroaches have to be removed. And he said, there are. It's true, he says, that this is Israel's doorway into Syria. There are, everything's not a conspiracy. And today, what does he do? A demand made for 25 years, Kurds get full citizenship. Then he turns to the conservative mullahs. He's governing from a minority sect, but it's a secular regime, so-called. He tells the same people that rose up in 1982 in the Hamar, he says, we are going to give you concessions. He's a sophisticated dictator. So, plus, he now well knows two things about his own population. Let's just assume. One is, Syria took the bulk of Iraqi refugees after 2003. Okay? Syria understands when Israel makes war in Lebanon. Recently, 2006. So Syria has had two major external powers attacking its neighbors. 2003 to the present, and Israel, of course, periodically, but most recently 2006. The last thing that population needs to be taught about is instability. He has played that card brilliantly. That's why I say sophisticated dictator. He's not a progressive, he's not a reformer, he's not a man of the future, forget all that. But he's a sophisticated dictator. He understands where to move. Gaddafi is an erratic, lunatic dictator. That's the difference between the two. Syria cannot have US intervention. It is much larger in the population centers. Okay, I cannot even understand what a war plan for Syria would look like. Turkey and Iran have already said we back the regime. Gaddafi was totally isolated immediately. One or two of his friends said, you are still my friend. Berlusconi dithering, because they partied together. You know, but Syria, he played his cards like a champion. Okay, again, don't mistake me. This guy is not a progressive, he's not a reformer, but he is a very sophisticated dictator.
But back to Libya for a minute. NATO's still bombing.
Well, it bombed killed 13 rebels yesterday. So it's not doing a very good job.
What outcome do you see? I mean, how do you see that?
I mean, it's a military stalemate. As it is, before the bombing, between, say, Ras Lanuf and Ajdabiya, they were going back and forth like a pendulum. One day the rebels advanced and everybody here got excited. Next day the rebels retreated. Then they advanced, then they got Then the bombing raid came and Gaddafi's troops moved further up. Past Sirte, they moved up. And then they figured out the bombing and then they moved forward again. There's a military stalemate. There's no breakthrough. In fact, in the transitional council, there are lots of debates breaking out. They just don't know what the political settlement is going to be. And there will be a political settlement. I personally do not think there's going to be a massive ground invasion. None of us mentioned Ivory Coast, Kenya. Yeah. By the way, the great wave can be related to Kenya. Don't you think? I mean, 1990s democratization, the constitution attempt in 2002, then 7-8 election crisis, 2010.
It hasn't gone forward.
But I mean, there have been different things happening below as well. Al Jazeera ran a terrible story saying this is an Arab thing and Africa below the Sahara is a failed. I mean, it's not true. There's Ivory Coast is in the middle of a process. But I can't tell you what's going to happen. All I'm saying is there's a military stalemate. People recognize that. And I don't know where you can go forward. One thing I'll say, that Republican from Pennsylvania, I think his name is Kurt Weldon, who is now in Tripoli, wrote a piece in the New York Times 2-3 days ago. He has met Gaddafi. He says, one thing I can tell you, I love the way he said it, Gaddafi cannot be bombed into submission. Similar things were said about Saddam Hussein. He crawled into a hole, remember, and had to be dragged out. These are not people that flee to Saudi Arabia, exile. They have different kinds of personalities. He's not worried. I mean, Al-Saleh is right now negotiating what will happen to my family. What will happen to the security service run by my nephew? You know, they are worried about their treats. This kind of character, they are erratic and crazy. He doesn't care. He, I'm going to die, I'm going to say. His family is insane. Yeah. I'll tell you the stories. Hannibal, Mutasim, they are one crazier than the other. Yeah. Back there in Denmark.
So it sounds to me like you've been arguing against Western military.
Of course.
Yeah. But say that we wouldn't have it there. What on earth would have happened? Because you say there would not. This is a Western ploy to reinstitute intervention of humanitarian rants, almost. I don't mean to imply that you're that conspiratorial. But anyways, the news reports that I was looking at from BBC just prior to the French started bombing of Benghazi. And even after the French bombing of Benghazi, when the initial reports after it came out, you could see pictures of tanks outside, lined up, ready to go into Benghazi. So what would have happened if we hadn't intervened? You might say that there wouldn't have been a genocide, but when you saw what happened to the opposition in Tripoli, where you had security forces going from door to door and killing people outright, is that something that... I understand... The hypocrisy of American foreign policy, right. But when we have the opportunity to intervene on what seems to me to be decent grounds,
right.
why not seize on that? There is an opportunity here to create impetus for NATO without the US or the European Union to intervene on humanitarian grounds, but the US do not have to be involved.
Right. So there are, I think, two or three things that I can say on that. One is, let's take the narrative again. When the tanks were outside Benghazi, it's not clear that they would have penetrated into Benghazi because they were facing resistance as well. The war had started. The battle of Benghazi had begun. They were not, you must not picture this as Benghazi as Tahrir Square and people singing and dancing inside and the tanks coming in, you know, instead of people on camels. This was not a case of unarmed people sitting in a city waiting. There was a military force. They had confronted each other already, right up the Mediterranean road. They were positioned to attack Benghazi. That is true. But they would have also been repulsed. People in Benghazi had heavy weaponry. The eastern divisions had defected to the side of the rebels. This is not just... You know, the pictures that you see, okay? You can, if you want, John Simpson in BBC has done a very good report on this. From Tripoli side. Pictures you see, he says, of people going back and forth, the people carrying a gun, walking, smiling, they're not going to the front. The front is held by military, the military that defected. What you're seeing is you're seeing people strolling like it's a picnic. Getting on. There was a picture, in fact, I wrote a story for a magazine came yesterday. They put a picture there of a guy had put a carbine on top of a truck and held it up with shoes. But they're not going to the front, you know. necessarily. They're not all going to the front. Some are going and coming back. But there are troops that are involved in this engagement. That is the troops that defected. So there is a line. That's how they are able to hold the line. You know, Gaddafi is bringing his hardened troops out. How could they have not swept them if they were just human rights activists who picked up the gun yesterday? So these are real troops. So let's not picture it as defenseless people being attacked. Okay, that's the first thing I would say. Second thing I would say is there were two options that were on the table. One option was others were going to go and talk immediately. Okay, the option that I would say nobody took seriously was an option to create a corridor from Egypt to Benghazi. There's an open road, war refugees could have been removed. If it's truly humanitarian, why do we always go to aerial bombardment and not creating a safe corridor to remove war refugees? Because it was a war in Benghazi. It was not defenseless people being attacked. You know, today the NATO commander said Gaddafi's troops are hiding among civilians. But so were the rebels inside Benghazi. That's the nature of this kind of war. I'm not defending hiding with civilians. I'm just saying that's an issue. If it's a good humanitarian response, remove civilians from the city. Let them get the option to leave. Civilians have moved up the road from Brega, Ashtabia to Benghazi. Open a corridor into Egypt. Why did the Egyptian military not get involved? Why is that question not there? I'm not saying involved in attacking Gaddafi, because they would not have done that. But they could have opened a corridor. The Tunisians opened a corridor. They allowed people to cross the border. Right? Then Tunisia faced immediately humanitarian crisis. So UN ships had to come. Turkish ships still going back and forth. Not the one going to Misrata, but Turkish ships going to Tunisia. So that would have been possible. So those are the two. Third thing I would say is, yes, going door to door, killing people. Fine? Every revolution in the Gulf has faced that. Today, I was following BBC in Cote d'Ivoire, in Abidjan, the rebels are going door to door and pulling out Gbagbo's people. It is going to be a bloodbath in Abidjan. And the French bombed Abidjan already, right, 2 days ago. But they bombed Gbagbo's ammunition dumps so that Ouattara's troops could enter. Ouattara's troops coming in and they're going door to door. So this door to door thing, I agree, is despicable. But this is not going to be stopped by aerial bombardment. I'm just talking strategy now with you. I don't want to get like who is morally, you know, like I want to save everybody in the world. This is not possible. I'm talking strategically. I agree. Going door to door and killing people is unacceptable. But how is aerial bombardment going to prevent it? Particularly when the bombardment begins, Zintan, Misrata, clamp down. Tripoli, working class districts, totally quiet. Now, you can't say that they're quiet because of repression alone. The propaganda is fierce. What are they saying? The colonial occupation has begun anew. These people are patriots as much as they are anti-Gaddafi. Just as in Iraq, when the Americans entered, people who may not necessarily have been anti-American, like the Sadrites, for instance, who had paid in blood much more than anybody else under Saddam. In fact, Muqtada's own father, and you know, they had paid in blood. But what did they do? Their patriotism was fierce. They came out and fought the American troops. So the intervention actually, I would say, has the opposite effect of helping along the rebellion. Because it will quiet elements that would have may have supported the Benghazi people. When you start having pictures of people in from Benghazi with French flags on Libyan tanks, inside working class areas, opposite reaction will happen. Because people are also patriotic. So what I would say is, I agree with you. It was a point of incredible confusion. You got all the reports, it was terrifying. But I'm telling you, the thing you have to cultivate is sober thinking. My friend Juan Cole lost his head. Gilbert, who I love, lost his head.
You have to be firm. Two more questions.
Yes.
Well, I agree that we shouldn't just go and bomb because war is the last solution for that. That's how I would think. But taking people out And this is not a small town, right?
No.
So it's a lot of people, so that will take a long time, and then what happens to the houses of people? Like, how would you bring them back? And what if Gaddafi didn't, give up, So, other options I was thinking of is negotiations with an Afghan. I know this is not, it's probably not something that anybody had thought of, because he's crazy, nobody can talk to him, whatever. But could we consider negotiations? And what about the peacekeeping process?
Well, let's take the peacekeeping because it's easy. The African Union is a toothless organization. It has been underfunded. It has not been able to work effectively where it's been placed, in Chad, in Darfur, in Ivory Coast. It doesn't have a great record. The African Union is underfunded. Plus, worse than that, Gaddafi was the great benefactor of the African Union. In fact, is it in Lusaka that he built a mansion for every head of state of African country when they have an African summit? They each have a house, big house, fancy house. I mean, he's spread Libyan oil money around the African Union. So the African Union had a certain problem. Nonetheless, they were sending a negotiating team because they understood the ramifications. But March 19th resolution circumvented the team. In fact, they were not allowed to fly into Tripoli. They still wanted to go March 20th, but they were told you cannot leave. The so-called member states of the UN that were conducting the operations. Because that's how the UN resolution is phrased. Member states can use all necessary measures.
Yeah.
So there was, not peacekeepers, but there was negotiation. You know, nobody is crazy, that crazy that you can't talk to them. Okay, so, and there are people, I would have said, Berlusconi, please, just go there. Okay, you are equally crazy, lunatic guy. Why is he any less crazy than Gaddafi? They are great pals. If you want to know about the great palliness, go on YouTube, watch the G8 luncheons. They'll be hugging and walking and drunk and looking at it. They are grotesque. Look, I would have said, these are your close. You know, one thing, people like me, Marxist type thinkers, we underestimate the power of personal friendship in international relations. So you have to actually understand these play a role. That's why Obama sent his emissary to talk to another lunatic. Why was Mubarak any less crazy? Mubarak ran the most brutal security service. Right? Under Mubarak's security service, his Umar Suleiman, his head of internal security, in fact, was, it is said, in Libya, when one of the so-called Al-Qaeda people was brought back, and the story is told that Umar Suleiman was involved in the torture. Slapped the guy, and the guy's mask fell in. He saw Omar Suleiman. He was considered by the Americans as a good replacement for Mubarak after Tahrir Square. Omar Suleiman, right? He gets made the vice president. He was physically involved in a torture in Libya. If we can send Wisner to talk to Mubarak, Gaddafi, who was on his knees to be friendly with the West, they had sent somebody. You want a humanitarian mission? Send Obama. You would have charmed the socks off him. Gaddafi would have said, take the whole East. He loves Obama. He just wrote a letter to Obama saying, thank you for removing your planes. You have left the Crusader mission. He's a crazy. But he would have. So why not? Why bomb before Obama? Send the Nobel Prize winner. But these things were not even on the table. And it's not a conspiracy. But I don't mind the conspiracy. This is not a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. It's a series of events. It's a process. You know, there's no conspiracy here. It's a series of events. When I suggest that a guy who lived in Vienna goes there, it's not a conspiracy. It's a convenient thing that the Americans had somebody, an asset in hand, who was respected by the military enough because he was a war hero in Chad, that they parachute him in. That's a convenience. It's always good to have reliable assets in hand.
So two more? One there. Yeah.
Your description of the change in the resistance in Libya brings to mind things that happened in the 1970s among the Mujahideen against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan and the CIA's manipulation of the legitimate resistance in Afghanistan. That's number one. And I wonder, you know, if this does stalemate, if it does not, if it is not settled, if that is what is to become in Libya, what you think about that. Second, and you may not want to take this on because it's just too big, Yemen.
Yeah, let's leave Yemen out. The Libya thing is not comparable to Afghanistan. One reason is Europe is too close. There will be too many refugees going to Italy. And it would be such a long-term bleeding that I don't think the EU would welcome. The Maltese certainly would not welcome, and Egypt is not going to play the role of Pakistan. You know, Egypt is definitely not going to be, you know, or play the role of Honduras, if you want to extend the model. You know, nor is Tunisia, nor will Algeria, nor will Chad certainly play the role of Honduras, you know, or Pakistan. So, I mean, I don't think it's that kind of model. Secondly, I actually don't think the rebels in eastern Libya are identical to the Mujahideen. Mujahideen were worse. I mean, the United States allied in Afghanistan with two of the most repellent characters in modern Afghan politics. One was Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, a horrible guy, and the other was Ahmad Shah Massoud, who for some reason has become like a Che Guevara figure. But, you know, in his youth, the two of them in Kabul University were vicious, vicious, misogynistic, hateful fellows. So the Americans decided they were better than the communists. Well, you know, the communist agenda in the 1970s looks good to me. You know, they allowed divorce by decree. They, by decree, did land reforms. I mean, they may have been crazy in their strategy, like they had no base outside the major cities and the military. They may have been crazy, but I don't think they were bad. But the United States there decided to go with the most horrible elements and build them up. But so I don't think these rebels are quite like that. I think there is a lot of that human rights kind of crowd that are there, these entrepreneurial, suave, European-educated people in Benghazi. I don't think these are quite throwing acid in the face of young girls in the engineering department. These are not those guys. So,
I mean, let's have one last one.
Yeah.
What do you think about Chavez's pronouncements in relationship to Latvia? I mean, talking about friends and, you know, that. Do you find that significant or maybe not?
Right.
I mean, that's why I said that thing about friendship. I was thinking about Chavez very much in that. There is a problem in the way they made their critiques. I mean, I cannot understand why they would consider Gaddafi to be part of their side of history. I mean, Gaddafi, since 69, lost the political discussion. As I said, he centralized power in the name of decentralization. He didn't even have a democratic agenda. Today, any person on the left has to have a democratic agenda. You know, that's the great lesson we learned from the Soviet Union, that if you don't have a democratic agenda, you are not a person of the future. So that's the first thing. And, you know, Chavez has, I think, learned that lesson, that he attempted a coup that failed, and then he's been elected, 10 times? Whatever, some god-awful number of times, they keep having elections. Now, people will say it's a rigged election. Our elections are rigged. I mean, what does rigged mean? That's a stupid thing. They believe in democracy, you know. Gaddafi does not believe in democracy. So he's on the wrong side of history. I mean, secondly, the way he has doled out oil revenues, they are not to build up the capacity of the Libyan people. They are simply transfer payments to buy loyalty. Transfer payments to buy loyalty is not socialism. Socialism, you have to build the capacity of the people. And if you travel to Venezuela, people are exploring all kinds of new ways of building the means of existence. So that way, in terms of program, there should have been nothing that united them. But this is the problem with friendship. Mm-hmm. And they are friends. And Ahmadinejad is a friend. And we need to theorize IR plus friendship. And people in IR don't consider friendship. And I think that's a big problem.
I know you had your hand up.
Yes, please.
It occurs to me that, I have a whole bunch of questions, but this is just this one, that I think this is the first time when the United Nations has essentially gotten involved militarily in, or sanctioned military intervention into sovereign state.
Right.
Essentially taken the fact aside from the Civil War. Essentially, since this is an active war, U.S. planes are, I think they're using Libya.
That's the best way to do humanitarian intervention.
Yeah, yeah.
Use uranium. But this is not the first time. There is, of course, Iraq.
Korea.
Which with Iraq and Kuwait. But
no, no. Second resolution in 2003. March 2003 resolution.
No, no, but the UN didn't sanction it.
Yes, it did.
Yeah. Remember, Colin Powell goes there.
February.
Yeah.
What was the resolution number? I don't remember.
Yeah.
He
and
goes,
Korea.
Remember, he goes and he does his thing with the... the mobile units that Al-Libi gave that its so-called intelligence.
To remove Iraq from Kuwait, I think.
So that was August 1990.
No.
Resolution came then, or November 1990. This is in 2003. Yeah, remember he came, Colin Powell. Wasn't there a resolution?
Yeah,
no,
it was.
The UN, the Security Council,
covered
up.
They didn't pass a resolution. There was a UN...
There was one about the weapons.
That's right, but that's enough.
But that was much more ambiguous.
But even this actually doesn't say, listen, here's the funny thing. This resolution, 1973, simply says establish a no-fly zone.
Yeah.
The French bomb.
Yeah.
What is Amr Moussa's first reaction, head of the Arab League?
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know you were going to bomb. We thought you were just going to establish a no-fly zone. Remember that?
Yeah.
And then Ban Ki-moon says, naughty boy, come here. And they have a joint press conference in Cairo. Standing next to Ban Ki-moon, Amr Moussa says, actually, we support this 100%. So, no resolution actually says, we authorize you to go to war.
Yeah.
I agree with you. That nobody has said, we authorize you to... But 1970 is so badly written.
Yeah.
I also agree that it's the first resolution which I've read, which has made me deeply uneasy. Behind the UN Security Council, there's a great mural made by, a Norwegian or Finnish artist. Okay, it's a white supremacist mural because in the middle there's a white family with a child and sort of they're looking out. It's like some weird thing. Below, there is it's very orientalist. There is somebody with a turban and they're all like this and then there's like this. And then there's a cannon, a howitzer cannon pointing at these brown people all shriveled up. And I thought that is the perfect metaphor for 1973. You know, it's what Gayatri Spivak says, white man saves brown woman from brown man. You know, in this case, that was Afghanistan, actually. This case is sort of white man saves brown man from brown man. You know, the war happening here, miserable, and this white supremacist family saying, we will take, and there's somebody reaching a hand down to pull them up. It's a grotesque mural. It's right there in the Security Council deliberation room. Okay, right behind them. So this resolution, I thought, stank. The worst that I've read.
So on that verb.
Okay.
This is a roller coaster ride. I'm going to be up way late tonight thinking about all the things you said. And
okay.
And I want a big round of applause for Vijay.
Thank you.
Thank you.